Thanks so much.
Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. So last time we started talking about support vector machines. So just to kind of recap what those were, we saw that we talked about how they were kind of a linear classifier, just like logistic regression, but they use a different method for choosing the separating hyperplane, or which of the many separating hyperplanes between the two classes to pick. So rather than using a likelihood-based criterion, they use this idea of the margin. And so we're talking about the SVMs are basically the combination of two ideas, doing maximum margin classification and the kernel trick. So last time we had just started to talk about what maximum margin was. And so we had this idea that you're looking for some separator here such that the the perpendicular distance to the nearest training points in either class is maximized. So you want to find the decision boundary that has the largest separation between the boundaries and the classes. And so we just started talking about how we would take this geometric intuition about what the margin is and write it down in an equation so that we can actually implement it in a computer program. So that's what got us started with this picture, which is where we left off last time. And so we talked about this last time, but if you have, all this was saying was that if I have some weight vector, which is this W tilde, and then this thing E is the normalized version of the weight vector. So it's the one where it's a unit vector. I divide it by the norm of W tilde. And then if I want, so say X1 and X, so that say that plane there is the decision boundary, the vertical one. And then X1 and X0 are the closest points to each of the classes. Then I can compute this perpendicular distance in blue between X1 and X0 using dot products. So what I can say is if I take the dot product of X0 with E, and I take the dot product of x1 with e, then I get this difference that's on the right-hand side. So that's this dot product of e with of x1 minus x0. And so since a dot product basically gives you the length of a projection, so that means that distance there that's in the little bracket is just the distance of those two dot products. Okay, so now, so that's where we were last time. And this time I'm going to talk about this next step. This next step of 2 over the norm of W twiddle, where does that come from? So let's start. So what we want to do at the end of the day is we want to convert this max margin intuition into an optimization problem. So we want something that says we want to minimize excuse me. So we want to have something that was in the form of the optimization problems that we saw last week. So we want something that says minimize some function of W and maybe under some constraints. And because once we do that, we can use all of this fancy technology from the constrained optimization literature that we sort of alluded to a couple lectures ago. And we can just apply that to solving this classification problem. So at the high level, what we're really looking for is we're looking for some maximization problem that says, you know, find the weight vector that has the maximum margin, subject to the constraints that all of the training examples are classified correctly. So what we want to do is find some way in math to say that English sentence. So the first thing you'd think to do is we already defined this notation about D plus and D minus, and you could express them as being maximizations over the training examples. So maybe I could just say to maximize those. And you could try to do that, but that's not such a good idea. And the reason for that is that these, you notice all of these optimization procedures that we talked about, fundamentally they use gradients. So they want objective functions that are differentiable, preferably differentiable everywhere. So things like quadratic bowls are great. You know, things with like things with sharp knots in them, or points of non-differentiability, they're not so good. So what we'd like, and we'd like even better, we'd like to have linear functions or linear constraints, because those are particularly easy to work with. So what we're going to do is we're going to use a couple of clever tricks in order to get a nice looking optimization problem from this geometric intuition. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to notice that we're going to try to remove some ambiguity in the problem. So for the first thing, suppose I give you one weight vector, and then I say, well, I'm going to multiply it by some constant c. So it turns out that that doesn't affect any of the classifications that you're doing, right? Because if I took a linear function of c times w tilde, that's always going to be positive or negative, right? So we said, well, the way you use those weights to make a classification is you take the dot product of the weights. We take a linear function of the weights. It's a dot product between the weights and the features. And you look at whether that's greater than 0 or less than 0. So obviously, multiplying things by some positive constant isn't going to affect their sign. So that means that it doesn't affect it. It defines the same hyperplane of the decision boundary. It doesn't affect the classifications that you would make. And you can see that you can also see that in the geometric intuition, right? That if I scale a vector by a length, if I scale a vector, it doesn't affect the hyperplane that's normal to it, right? It's still orthogonal to all of the things that would have been orthogonal to before. So that causes a bit of a problem, because you might say, well, if I'm trying to make the margin really big, then in some sense, by picking C, I can change the units. So I can say, I've got a 1,000 millimeter margin. That's great. That's much better than your 1 meter margin, right? So we want to pick the units in some way that's sane and doesn't give us kind of trivial solutions where we want to take C closer to zero, and it looks like the margin's getting bigger when really it's not. So in some sense, we need to define some standard form for W, or some standard set of units. And there are lots of things you could imagine doing. You know, you can imagine doing something like, say, I'm only going to consider weight vectors whose norm is 1, so they live on the unit ball. And that would be one thing you could do, but it turns out that's not the most clever thing you can do. So we're going to do something a little bit more clever. So we're going to do this thing that's on the first equation on the slide. We're going to say that we're going to impose a new constraint on the optimization problem. So this is going to end up being a constrained optimization problem at the end of the day, and we're going to add another constraint that picks the scaling of W. So different weight vectors in different directions are going to have different scaling factors, but that's okay. So the constraint we're going to say is that the minimum value over all the training examples xi of this thing, which is the dot product of the weight vector with the feature vector plus the bias, we're saying if you take the absolute value of that, minimize it over all the training examples, we're going to demand that that's 1. So what does that mean geometrically? So if you go back to these distances, so maybe I should explain it this way. So if you go back to this thing, WTXI plus W0, that's the discriminant function, right? That's the thing that you use to say whether a training example is positive or negative or not. So we're scaling it in such a way that no training example gets a value of less than 1. So in some sense, what we're saying is look at this point x1, look at this point x0. Whichever one of them is closest, we're going to pick the scale of the weight vector such that that blue distance is 1. So in this case, we're picking we'll pick a scale for w tilde in such a way that the shorter blue distance, the one for x1, is 1. So we define the margin, if you remember, as being the minimum of d plus and d minus. So we defined it as being, well, whichever example from either class is closest to the decision boundary, that's going to define the margin. And so what this constraint here is saying is we're going to scale things so that that distance is 1. And then the thing that we're going to maximize, so now it makes sense to maximize that thing, but we'll just maximize the distance between the positive and the negative. So we'll maximize d plus plus d minus. And that's fine. So that adds another constraint on the weight vector. So first we're going to have constraints that say whatever weight vector I end up picking, I want it to classify all of the instances correctly. So this is only going to make sense if the training instances, in fact, are linearly separable. So first we'll have this. That's what these top two constraints say. They just say for all the positive instances, I want the discriminant score to be greater than or equal to 0. For all the negative instances, I want the discriminant score to be less than or equal to 0. So those are the first two constraints. And the third constraint is the scaling thing. OK, so that's fine. So now these are three constraints. One of them has a minimization in it. Now that's not differentiable everywhere, so that's not so great. So now it turns out we can do another clever thing, which is we can rewrite these three constraints in another form. That's a lot nicer. And that's this lower thing that's on here. So let me see if I can, that's the middle board.
Rear board?
No. Front. Oh, but there's not, oh, it's one over there. Front.
There.
Okay. So we're going to say, so we can unpack that thing into two parts. The first thing you can do is you can combine the top two constraints. And the way you do that is you notice, well, if I take negative 1 times the second constraint, so if I multiply both sides by negative 1, then I get the same thing as the first constraint. But negative 1 is the same thing as the class label. So what I can do is if I just take the first two constraints and I turn them into yi, w tilde transpose xi plus w0 is greater than or equal to 0. So that combines. Now, if yi is positive, I get the top constraint. And if yi is negative, I get the middle constraint. So I've now combined the first two constraints into one compact form. So now I've got to get the third constraint into it. OK, so the first thing you notice is that so now I'm saying that this thing has to be greater than or equal to 0. But that minimum is the same thing as saying that if the minimum of all these things equals 1, then that means that each one individually has to be greater than or equal to 1, right? Because if any of them were less than 1, then that would be then that constraint wouldn't be satisfied. So if I say that, so now if I say that the absolute value wt tilde xi plus w0 is greater than or equal to 1, so that's just another way of writing that. That's implied by that minimization. And that's good. So now what we can do on top of this is it turns out that by doing this trick, I don't have to worry. So now we want to get rid of the absolute value. And it turns out that that's fine too, because if these constraints hold, then I know that this thing is already always positive. So if I just do, So it turns out that this and this together imply the constraint on the bottom, right? And the reason for that is that, well, we already know, so say yi is positive, then I know that this thing is greater than or equal to 0, which means I don't need to worry about this thing here. And then multiplying it by yi is just 1, so that doesn't change anything. So I get that thing on the bottom. And the similar argument works in reverse for the negative class. So it turns out this bottom thing just gives us a compact way of getting the same set of feasible vectors w hat as the top three constraints. So what have we gotten so far? We're trying to set up a constrained optimization problem. So the first thing we did is we came up with a clever way of writing the constraints that say we have to do a good enough job of classifying the training data, but we also need a function to minimize or maximize. And we started out saying, well, we want that to be the margin. So let's see if we can have a clever way of writing the margin as well. So it turns out there is. It turns out that you can that within these constraints that we've defined, that if those constraints hold, that you can prove that the margin is 1 over the norm of w hat. So how do you do that? So it turns out that's actually not that complicated. It's just a little bit of algebra. So one thing we know is that is that if you look at the max margin solution, and then look at two points x plus and x minus, and that are the closest ones to the boundaries. So if on this picture it would be like that zero, that O and that x where those two lines go through. So one of those O's would be x minus, and then the x would be x plus. Now, it turns out that, and you can kind of see this geometrically, that once I find the separating hyperplane that has the maximum margin, the distance to the O's and the distance to the X's has to be the same. And that seems obvious, because if it weren't, you could always push it a little bit farther from the one that it's closest to, and you get a solution that had better margin. So what that means in the notation that we were using before, with this D plus and D minus, is that at the maximum likelihood solution, at the maximum margin solution, sorry, we know that d plus has to equal d minus. And then, if on top of that, if you take this constraint here, it says, well, the closest of either of them has to be 1. Right? So what that tells us is that both that at the max margin solution, both d plus and d minus are going to be 1. So that's the thing that we get here. So for the 2 points on the boundaries, if I take the closest positive point, I'm going to get 1. And so this, if I take basically the discriminant function of the positive point, I'm going to get 1. And then similarly, if I take the discriminant function of the negative point of the closest negative point, well, it's going to be negative because we're assuming that I'm at the solution and it's correctly classified. Then I get minus 1. So then, if I look at the I'm going to take the orthogonal distance between those 2 points, like was on that handwritten diagram that we saw on the first slide, and then we saw from that diagram that that the difference between those two was W twiddle transpose was just the difference between those two projections, which was W, which is where I get this W twiddle tilde W transpose x plus minus x minus. So since each one of those things independently is 1, so now we can actually solve the left-hand side of that thing. Because we know W transpose x, so we have two W zeros that are going to cancel. And then we know W transpose x, that gives me 1. And then W transpose x minus gives me another 1, so I get 2 there. And then if I divide both sides by the norm of W, then I get this thing at the bottom, that the distance between this distance between the closest positive point and the closest negative point is 2 over the norm of W. And so and to derive that, so we had to assume that we were within this clever constraint set that we defined on this slide. And that's fine, because any answer that we're going to get from this optimization problem is going to be within the constraint set. So it's fine to do transformations that assume that the constraints are satisfied. OK, so why do we do this? So we did this so that we'd have a nice smooth function to optimize, instead of this to convert the margin into a nice function to optimize. And so we ended up with this thing 2 over the norm of W twiddle, of W tilde. So the nice thing is that if I want to maximize the margin, well, that means I want to maximize 2 over the norm of W tilde. Well, it turns out that's the same thing as minimizing the norm. This is the Euclidean norm of W tilde squared. And the reason for that is that the function 1 over x is monotonically decreasing. So if I want to maximize 1 over x, then I want to take x close to 0. So that means that maximizing 1 over x is the same thing as minimizing x. So that's what lets me maximize the norm of w tilde. And then if I want to maximize a function, that's the same thing as maximizing its square. So that's how I convert it into that. So that's all the clever tricks we need. So now we get this really nice form for the optimization problem for SVMs. So this is how the weights for an SVM are determined. Is basically you use some computational procedure to solve this optimization problem, which is minimize over all possible weight vectors W, the norm of W tilde, which is basically everything in W except for the bias, except for W zero, subject to the constraint that for all training instances that thing holds. So basically that the discriminant function for the training instance is greater than or equal to 1. And so that's it. That's what you optimize in an SVM.
Why do we need the square?
Why do we need the square? It just makes things easier. Because that thing in the norm is a Euclidean distance. It has a square root in it, right? So, and you just want to get rid of the square root. OK, so how are you going to find this optimum? So it turns out that you use this. You can use this technology that I very briefly alluded to a couple lectures ago, which is this thing called Lagrange multipliers, and that's and they're a very general way of dealing with a constrained optimization problem. And when you use Lagrange and so we talked about the geometric intuition behind them a couple lectures ago, and you don't necessarily need to remember that to use or to know what a Lagrange multiplier is in order to use an SVM. But the thing that happens when you use a Lagrange multiplier is you get one multiplier for each constraint. And so, see, here we had one constraint for every training instance. So we're going to end up with one Lagrange multiplier for every training instance. And basically, if you go through a lot of this optimization stuff, what turns out you can show is that the optimal value for the hyperplane takes this nice form. So it's a form that's just a linear combination of the training examples. So the weights are what you do this constrained optimization procedure to figure out. But it means you can think of the problem instead of optimizing over however many features you have, however many components of W, that you're optimizing something that depends on then you can think of the optimization as being over alpha instead. And so you have one of those alpha for each training instance. So the first thing is, well, if you had many fewer training instances than you had features, then this Lagrangian representation would be kind of nice, right? Because having fewer dimensions to optimize is always better. And so it would be, if it turns out, so, and I only need one, and in this Lagrangian formulation, you only need one alpha for each training example. But you might say, well, how typical is that? Well, I mean, how much does that help, right? Well, if it turns out there's even something better, which is something else that you can see from the geometric intuition, but it turns out you also get it when you go through this optimization machinery. And that's that most of the training instances don't do anything to determine the max margin solution. So if I go back to, so if I go back to this picture here, I could move this training instance on the left, I could move that O anywhere I wanted over here, and that wouldn't affect the max margin solution, right? Because it's nowhere near the decision boundary. It's only if I started to move that O over here, then that would start to change the optimal parameters for the SVM. So it turns out that you can that if you go back to this Lagrangian formulation, if you solve for the optimal W or equivalently the optimal alpha for the SVM, all of those training instances that are nowhere near the decision boundary, they'll get an alpha equal to zero. So that so what that means is that if you want to do prediction on a new data point, you can just ignore those training instances when you're doing prediction. So let me make that a little bit more specific. How would you use this weight vector in order to do prediction? What you do is you follow these two things on the bottom. So you would say, you would just be just like any other linear classifier, just like you would do, say, with logistic regression. You would say, well, let me take this linear function of the features and see if it's greater than a threshold. So typically greater than zero. So that's fine. That doesn't tell you anything that you didn't know from the first slide. But now that you have this thing up at the top, you can substitute in that form for W tilde. And then what you get is that all I need to do is to sum over all of my training examples of alpha I, yi, times the dot product of x of the thing that I'm trying to classify and that training example. And so the reason you get that is because you had an x there, and then xj comes in from that equation at the top. So in some sense, what it's doing, so and this summation, obviously, you don't have to include the terms for which alpha I is 0. So this can be a summation over what are called the support vectors. So the support vectors are simply those small number of training examples that are closest to the hyperplane. And so those are the ones for which alpha I is not equal to 0. And also, it turns out that they're also the ones for which that constraint on the bottom, for some training examples, that's a greater than or equal to, right? So for some training examples, the function on the left-hand side is going to be a lot bigger than 1. And for some function, some other ones, it'll be exactly equal to 1. And the ones where it's equal to 1, if you look at the geometry, those are the support vectors. So in some sense, this is kind of interesting because, a dot product tells us something about how close two vectors are, right? So if you remember from linear algebra, not from linear algebra, from just vector calculus and stuff, that the dot product tells you something, well, actually, even before calculus. But anyway, if you remember from any maths course you've had, the dot product tells you something about the cosine between two angles. So what this is saying is that I'd expect that two vectors that are close, if the training vectors that are closest to the one that I'm trying to classify now should have the most impact on the class label. And that's actually what you get from that equation. And the other thing that's good to notice right now is that, um, is that this depends on the training data, but it depends on the training data. All it depends is on dot products of two training vectors, two feature vectors. So if I had some really good trick, so that could be, if I had lots of features, that could take a really long time, right? Obviously, if I had a million features, then computing this dot product could take a very long time. But if I had some fancy technique for computing dot products that was really, really fast, I could plug that in here, and I'd get a much faster method for doing prediction. So it turns out that will be that would be really important in a couple of slides. Okay, so that's it. So that's everything about linear. Well, no, it's not. That's everything about SVMs. So let me put it this way. Okay, everything we've done so far has kind of sucked, and the reason for that is that it assumed the training data was linearly separable. So when does that happen, right? If we want a practical method, then we have to do something in the case where the training data isn't separable. So what happens if I just take the algorithm that I've told you so far and I applied it to a data set that's not linearly separable? So what's going to happen is at some point your optimization is going to come back to you and yell at you. And the reason is that you would have given it an optimization problem that has no solution, right? Because if I went back here, with this constraint in the bottom, it implies that linear classifier is getting all the training examples right. And that can never happen if I have a data set that's not linearly separable. So this optimization problem has no solution in that case. So I have to do something a little bit more clever. Intuitively, what I'd like to do is if I have a data set that's not linearly separable, I'd like to say, okay, you're allowed to make some mistakes, but try to minimize them, try to make as few mistakes as you can. So you want to add some kind of penalty term into the optimization problem such that, you know, to try to minimize the mistakes. And that's basically what you do. So you add this variable kc for each training instance, and those are called slack variables. So you're going to add that in so that these constraints don't have to exactly be satisfied, but they only have to be sort of satisfied. And the way you do that, each of these kc's is going to be greater than or equal to zero. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say each one of these constraints, instead of saying, well, this function has to be greater than or equal to one, I'll say it's 1 minus kci. So that reflects the degree to which I was not able to satisfy the constraint that I wanted to satisfy. And then I just do the same thing with the opposite sign for the negative examples. So it says, how far am I from satisfying this constraint? That's what the c says. And then when I go up into the objective function that I'm trying to minimize, I'll add in another term that says sum over all training examples of these error terms and try to make them as small as I can. I could just say, well, I'll add in the sum over all, since these things are always positive, I could just like add in the sum over all of them and be done with it. But in order to make the method more flexible, I'm going to add in a couple of parameters. So I'll say, well, if you want to optimize the square or the cube, you know, that's fine, because it changes the relative weight of the W tilde term and this and the slack term. But still, I mean, it's still, your penalty is still a monotonic function of the slack variables, so it still kind of makes sense. So I'll give you this variable k, which basically allows you to penalize more or less violations of the constraints. So you could do that. I mean, typically you set k equals 1, but you could set it to another value if you really wanted to. The parameter that's really important is this thing c. So what c does is it says, basically, I have two objective functions that I'm trying to satisfy at the same time, right? I have this minimize the norm of w tilde that I want to satisfy, and I have this minimize the slack variables that I want to satisfy. So anytime I have a multi-objective optimization problem, I still have to make one decision. I still have to pick one w at the end of the day. So how much do I care about minimizing slack versus minimizing the norm of w tilde? And so you might want a way to trade off those two things. And that's what C gives you. So if I set C to like 1,000, then I'd work really, really hard to find something that comes as close to separating the training examples as I can, at the risk of the other one. So it depends on what penalty I want to give to errors. So if you look at this graphically, you can look at it like this. So say I have one negative instance that happens to be, I have a non-separable case. I got this one O on the right that I can't classify correctly. Then what this error term is, what the Casilla ends up being at the optimum is just the distance between that bad example and where it should be if it were on the right side of the decision boundary. So graphically, this is what the slack variables are doing, and it makes sense that I'd want to minimize that if I'm trying to classify the training data well. So that's how you handle the non-separable case in an SVM. But remember, I said at the beginning, that's only half of what an SVM does, right? I said an SVM was the max margin classification plus the kernel trick. So what is the kernel trick, and why do we want to use it? We've kind of motivated this trick throughout this course. We said, well, linear methods are very nice because they're computationally easy to work with, but they're restricting because you only get linear decision boundaries. So if I want a nonlinear decision boundary, then what we've said is, well, you can add more features, right, that allow you to represent nonlinear functions to the input. So for example, maybe if I had a two-dimensional input space, maybe I want to talk about quadratic functions of the input. So I might want some feature vector like this that has x1 squared. Instead of just doing x1 and x2, I might want x1 squared, x2 squared, and some cross term here. So that's fine, but that's fine if I only want a small number of features. But maybe I want a really, really big number of features. Maybe I would want one. Maybe I want a very high order polynomial features, or maybe I want, I might even want an infinite number of features. I might want some kind of very squiggly continuous decision boundary. So it turns out there's a really nice trick you can do. So if you go back to the solution in the linear algorithm, remember there was this point where I said in order to predict a new input, the only thing you need are dot products between feature vectors. So it turns out that if you want to, so that's true for predicting on a new input. It turns out that it's also true that if I want to do solve that optimization problem to find the best weight vectors, it turns out you can also implement that using only dot products between feature vectors. So what that means is that if I have some kind of basis expansion, so if I've transformed my original features into some expanded space, so if I've transformed x to phi of x, then the transformed algorithm only depends on dot products between phi. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to define this thing called a kernel function. And the idea behind a kernel function is it basically defines your feature representation. It's a way there are some mathematical requirements for what makes a function a kernel function, and I'm not going to talk about what those are, but basically they ensure that I can interpret a kernel function as a dot product between functions of the feature vector. So there are certain rules that all dot products have to obey. And if I had a kernel function that violated those rules, it wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't correspond to any feature vector. But under some conditions, there's a large variety of functions that are kernel functions. And basically, what a kernel function does is it gives you a way of defining distances between training examples. It gives you a way of defining dot products. And the reason why you want to make that switch is because if the dimensionality of phi of x could be very, very large, it could even be infinite, but sometimes even with very large vectors, there are efficient ways of computing dot products. So the example that we have, so an example would be if you want to do this feature representation at the bottom where you have quadratic features, it turns out that you can do that just by taking the dot product of these two of x1, x2, and then squaring it. So it turns out if you use this kernel function, that's the same thing as doing, this kernel function is the same thing as phi of x transpose phi of xj squared. So that's one example, a simple example of a kernel function. A more complex example would be a radial basis kernel. So what that's saying is that I'm going to say that the two data points are close to each other, based on the Gaussian distance between them. So it's as if I put a Gaussian density centered at xj, and then I said, well, what's its density at xi? And if that's close, then I'm going to say, then those two points should have more of an effect on each other. And you see, this kernel has a parameter. It has a parameter alpha, which is the same thing as the standard deviation parameter of a Gaussian. Now, in this case, you can't, one thing that's interesting about this kernel is that if you try to write down the feature vector phi that corresponds to it, it's infinite. Because if I get any test point, so once I give you some new point in the test data that wasn't in the training data, it's going to have a different set of dot products to all of the training points. So it turns out you can't come up with a transformation phi to a finite dimensional space that gives you the same effect as this kernel function. So that's but if I use the kernel trick in order to do prediction, then I can still do classification in a finite amount of time, even though in some sense I have an infinite dimensional feature vector. And so actually, and the way you do prediction is just as we said here, it's the same thing as the linear case, except instead of using a dot product here, you compute this kernel function. So you can see graphically what you get is something like this. That the way that this expands the power of a linear classifier is that something that in a low-dimensional space might look like some kind of oval, if you had it in a radial basis space, just looks like a straight line. So I get the I can so that means I can use all of the mathematical machinery of a linear classifier, but I'm still getting these nonlinear decision boundaries, like on the left. Okay, so this is just a graphical kind of a diagram that tells you the same thing as the equation that's down here. So what this diagram says is, well, how do I suppose I have a new training example, and I have a test example that I want to classify, and I've already run training. What do I do? So this is an example from digit classification. So each one of these things are a handwritten digit, like on a check. And I want to say, well, how do I come up with the eventual label? What I do is I use this kernel function k, that's this thing in blue, and I take this new example, and I compute the value of the kernel function at each of the support vectors. And then once I've done that, I take those weights. So that's sort of like a comparison of this new input with all of the ones that were closest to the decision boundary. Now then, each of those support vectors has weights, which are the Lagrange multipliers that came from this optimization problem. So now if I weight the comparison values by those and sum them up, and that's what gives me the eventual classification. So this is just a way of visualizing the equation that was on the last slide. Okay, so there are two kinds of free parameters that we have with this kind of method. One is what kernel that you use. And that's basically the same kind of problem as what features do you want if I were writing out the features by hand. So typically, you just have to use your knowledge of the problem and trial and error on a validation set to choose phi. With C, it's kind of harder to choose. It's harder to just guess a good value of C offhand, because who knows what trade-off you want to make given the problem that you're facing. So people have tried to talk theoretically about how C affects the freedom that the classifier has to pick different decision boundaries. So I mean, there's some sense in which C is trading off, is doing some kind of overfitting control. But I mean, in practice, those methods probably aren't so useful for actually picking what value of C you would use. So you would just use, typically people would just use cross-validation. Okay, so here's an example of applying SVMs to a real data set. So this is a pretty nice data set. So these are zip codes, these are postcodes that people in the US wrote on their mail. And now like, the vast majority of postcodes, even handwritten ones, are read automatically. And there's only a very, very small percentage of mail that a human has to look at to route. And one way you could try to figure out, recognize what the postcodes are using SVMs. So if you look, there's an example of doing this in this book that I cite here. Basically, what they do is they scan the postcode off the letter, and they convert it into a 16 pixel by 16 pixel image. And then they have the training signal is just which of the 10 digits is it. And so they train an SVM on it with various different kinds of kernels. And on this particular, this is an example of a task in which it works very well. So I think they get, like they say here, they get, basically, I think they get about 90, they get 4% error. They get about 96% of the digits correct with this kind of off-the-shelf type of method. And you do see that, and one thing you see that's fairly general is that the number of support vectors does tend to be fairly small. So in this case, about 4% of the data set was support vectors. So that's on order of a couple hundred support vectors out of a data set of 7,000. So that's one kind of application to SVMs that's been successful. There are other applications like text categorization. So if I have a document and I want to classify what topics is it about from a predefined list, that's another application in which SVMs have been very successful. And things like face detection and images. Okay, so let's kind of go back and compare this to the other linear classifiers that we've seen. Basically, what we've seen is that all of these things are trying to find a linear decision boundary, a linear hyperplane, but they choose it in different ways. And also, they're converting this learning problem into an optimization problem. So they're basically choosing a different objective function in the optimization problem. And you can think of that as penalizing errors in different ways. So it turns out that you can both SVMs and logistic regression you can write as being this as minimizing this error over training examples, and there's this kind of interesting theory that I won't go through about what exactly is the difference between logistic regression and SVMs, and the way you can think about it is. Do I want to draw this? Yeah, I can draw this picture. It's not that. So there's this very famous picture that says this is for binary classification. So the x-axis is basically ywtx, right? So this is actually I'll write it this way: y twiddle x plus w zero. So this is just the discriminant function that was on the previous slide. And then I'm multiplying it by y such that this way I'm always correct and this way I'm always incorrect. So both of these methods want to penalize being wrong. And it turns out that if I look at the loss for look at the error function for logistic regression, it looks something like this. And then if you look at the loss for SVMs, it looks something like this one is correct. So that has to be it's going to be like this. And then for SVMs, it looks something like this. So that's not. Whoops. Okay. I'm getting really excited. Okay. So you have to do quite a bit of mathematical manipulation to see how do I convert logistic regression and SVMs in the form that I've described to something that looks like this. But it turns out there kind of is a general way of thinking about how their loss functions differ. So that's one thing that's similar. Another thing that I want to point out is that this kernel trick is something that's actually very general. So a lot of people associate the kernel trick with SVMs because that's one of the things that makes them so effective and so effective as classifiers. But the kernel trick can be used in any algorithm that depends only on dot products. So it turns out that you can kernelize logistic regression and get some of the same advantages of having this having a potentially infinite set of features, or even things like linear regression, k-nearest neighbor, all of those things you can think about, you can kernelize. So that's okay. So that's basically what I have to say about SVMs. So just to pound it into your memory again. So an SVM is just this kind of geometric max margin idea with a kernel trick. And so that gives us a way of saying, well, we're making a nonlinear decision boundary look like a linear decision boundary. And then we had this trick of, we had this trick of slack variables, which allowed us to apply this maximum margin idea even when the data wasn't linearly separable. And then the nice thing is that we had this theoretical kind of advanced theoretical result that said that I can compute the optimal hyperplane. So I can compute the optimum value of W tilde has a linear combination of the support vectors, the ones that were closest to the decision boundary. And these are one of the most effective and most highly used classifiers today. So if you have kind of an off-the-shelf classification problem, I mean, they're not always as fast as doing decision trees to train, especially when you have a large data set. But they tend to perform very well across a wide variety of problems. So it is a good kind of go-to method before you try anything else.
And you know, one thing that's interesting about this is you would think that if I have a high dimensional feature space, that would be really, really bad from what we said before about doing overfitting, right? We saw that, oh, if I have a polynomial kernel, then that can make I can just interpolate through all the data points. So we saw that having too many features was bad. So having an infinite number of features, that's got to be even worse than having too many features. So it was a very interesting thing about this max margin idea that it does some kind of regularization, right? That it says it helps to reduce the tendency to overfit in high dimensional spaces. And so so there's this interaction between max margin and the kernel trick, that max margin kind of helps the kernel trick out with SVMs. That's what I have to say about SVMs. Are there any questions? Kind of gone pretty fast, but any derivations you'd like to see that I didn't show? Oh, I should say, if you do want to read more, this is not required for. It's not going to be used on the exam. So the examinable readings are the ones that are on the first slide. So there's a handout, and then there are some. There's a handout, obviously, in addition to the slides. But also there is, where did I have it? It's right here. Yeah, this book here, it's like this thick, and it's all about SVMs and kernel methods. So if you really wanted to go off, I guess, during Christmas or something, and study something that wasn't going to help you in any of the exams, but it's really cool, then that's a nice book to look at. Okay, thanks, I'll see you next time.
So you get a full lecture of.
Yeah, I'll do a full lecture. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's definitely a full lecture. So then it's all you.
All right.
Hi.
Excuse me. I wrote him an email on Friday about the special history at.
Oh, yeah. So there's something I need to check on about that. I don't have a problem with you being in learning from data. I was going to have so I know PMR has a couple of assignments, right? Have those happened yet? Has the first one happened yet, or?
Well, I think it's due on the 1st of November. It's due today or the 4th of November, I don't know.
Okay, so I guess the one question, do you already know about the procedure for switching degrees? I don't know if you have to do that.
Yeah, I read it.
Okay, so I don't have a problem with you doing that. I guess the other thing, there's one other thing that I could check on, whether it would make sense for you to just kind of do the degree without PMR, which is fine, but since you've been going to all the classes, you could just like drop a class and take PMR for real, right? And it wouldn't be that, I don't know how you'd feel about that. I'll ask some people for advice about which of those solutions seems best, because I haven't had quite this, but we need to figure out which of those two makes the most sense, and I'm not sure about that right now.
Okay.
But in principle, no, I don't have any problem with you switching.
So I do. Basically, I should wait an email from you, or I can email a course organizer for the.
You can go ahead. Yeah, go ahead and email the course organizer to commence. I would. Yeah. Let me see. Let me. I'll send you an email tomorrow, and then about this, and then we can figure out which way what to do with the course organizer.
All
but
right.
we'll work it out somehow. But
okay.
Yeah.
Sure. You discussed about two classes.
Yes.
What about multiple classes?
Yeah. So multiple classes are a little bit more difficult. There's a couple different, basically what you do is you convert a multi-class, that's kind of a downside of SVMs. So basically what you do is you convert a multi-class classification problem into a series of binary classification problems.
That's what you did about the digit identification?
Yeah.
You had multiple.
Yeah, so one way you can do it is you can say one versus one. So you could take like all pairs,
okay,
or some number of pairs.